Thank you, Brother Gary and Brother John Wayne. Good. Appreciate the song service this morning and the very humble prayer, Brother James. There's a difference between praying to the people and praying for the people, and I appreciate Brother James's prayer for Preetboro and for the continuation of the service. As y'all know, the virus we have that has been mentioned a couple of times here, it's still supposed to get worse before it gets better. It's still, you know, and we got a new strain now that apparently is hitting a lot of people. So, y'all do what you need to do to take care of yourselves. I mean, again, whatever makes you feel comfortable, do that. I have got fortunate, lucky. I don't like to think of it as lucky. I think fortunate, a blessing of the Lord. I got my first vaccine shot. I've got number one out of the way now. 2 weeks tomorrow, so I'll looking to get a second shot around the 1st of February then, and that'll help. But I'm even told then you can still be a carrier, even though you're immune to it now. You can still get it and pass it on. You may get it in your breath or something and pass it on immediately in a little bit. So they're still telling me you need to wear a mask when you're out in public and things. But I feel blessed that the Lord worked it out for me to be able to get it. Lubbock, for whatever reason, has developed a very good system, and they've got on Governor Abbott's favored list since Lubbock has been a hot spot in that area up there. And so Abbott has sent more than a prorated share to Lubbock because they're administering it. When they get 1,000 doses, they administer it within one day after it gets there. So they're putting it in a lot of people, and they've organized it and publicized it. And the organization was just outstanding. I mean, they had in the Civic Center, tables you come in and register and you sign in and sign the consent form. You go around behind a little partition wall and they got 20 nurses at stations. And just as fast as you round that corner, they'll say, you go to table number 5, you go to table number 6. And you get it, and it took, I was there 45 seconds. I mean, they administered it to me and didn't feel anything but a little prick in my arm. And not even as bad as any of the shots, certainly not as bad. I had to go for my annual checkup and they took my blood, and actually taking my blood caused more of a stick to me than that did. And then you round another little petition. They had all the Lubbock firemen volunteering there, and they would have you sit down, and they watch you for 15 minutes to make sure you don't have any adverse reaction. And they organize it, and they're directing people on where they should go. And they call your name out when your 15 minutes is up. They keep track of it. And they've got it organized, and I wasn't in the building 25 minutes. I mean, from start to finish, and that included the 15-minute wait. So they really had it down nice and good. And it provides a little bit of comfort, mostly psychologically, than anything else. When you get it, you're half through. And one of the firemen gave me a tip. He said, now, your arm's going to get a little sore the next 2 or 3 days. It'll get a little sore. And he said, you've got a lot of that vaccine is all right there under that skin. Told me to work my arm two or three times today, especially work your arm. And that'll work the vaccine more into your body and get it out of you, just so much in your arm, which makes it sore. And he said, and it'll help eliminate the soreness if you'll do that. And so I spent all the day, every time I think of it, well, I'd raise my arm up and wipe it around. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it worked. I didn't have much soreness. The next 2 days, I had it right there where I could touch it. I could feel it right there where they pricked me. Other than that, I didn't have any soreness at all, so. It seemed to work well, and so those of you that think you might like to do it, it's pretty simple and pretty easy. And if you do some routine stuff, like I said, work the vaccine in your arm. So, but that's up to each one of you. But you do what you need to do to take care of yourself. I want to speak to you this morning on a subject that represents a lot of what I think are the old preachers used to call it types and shadows. You know, there's some things hidden underneath the surface by types and shadows. Go back in the Old Testament, and there's a lot of types that you'd see, and then they're represented again by Christ or by things that happen in the New Testament. You don't really know it till you see the New Testament. Then you can look back and you understand what was going on. One's a type and one's a shadow of things to come or things that are past. And I want a little bit like that, except I call it symbolism. It's the same thing. One is a symbol of the other. So I'm going to start with a subject that you know, and then I want to get into three events that happened in the New Testament that I hope have a little meaning and have a little symbolism attached to it, that if the Lord will be with us, we can see it. John, Book of John, chapter 3, is a subject that all of you are familiar with. You know it, you've heard it many times. The problem is most people don't go read it. They don't actually go read it, but it's a subject of being born again. You hear this said a lot and suggested a lot. Almost every religion will tell you, you need to get born again. And, of course, they relate it to eternal salvation, and it's clear that everyone that's going to go to heaven will be born again. But in this context, being born again means you get to enjoy the kingdom of heaven today. That's what being born again actually means. You get to see the kingdom of heaven today. The kingdom of heaven, a lot of people think, well, that's what's going to happen with the thousand-year reign. No, as I preached about last month, the kingdom of heaven is taking place right now. Christ is on his throne now. And all the events of Revelations where they talk about being a thousand-year reign, that's what's going on now. 1,000 years is an era, and we're in that era now, the kingdom of heaven. So being born again, though, in chapter 3, let me summarize it real quickly and talk about it. They'll talk about you got to be born again. And they'll say you got to be born again before you can go to heaven. Well, you will be born again to go to heaven, but that's not what it's about. It's being born again so that you can see what's taking place today. You can understand your need of Christ today. When you're born again, Christ puts himself in you, and you know it, and he reveals himself. And therefore, going forward, you have a sense of guilt when you do something wrong. You know, that doesn't mean you're not, unless you're like me. I still do stuff wrong every now and then. After it's over, I went, oh, gosh, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. And I should have, gone to church. I should have read my Bible. I feel guilty when I don't do what Christ has instructed me to. Doesn't really have any direct impact on you're going to heaven, but it has a direct impact of your understanding that you've already got a place in heaven. It gives you a great understanding. That's what being born again is about. We had a minister there in Lubbock who made a real big deal, and they all will. So, if you're not born again, you better get yourself born again real quick. And if we go, and this is the place where born again is talked about. It's mentioned one other time. But right here in chapter 3 of John is where it tells us what born again is. He actually lays it out. And the problem is, people don't go read it. They just understand the first deal where Christ says in verse 3, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. And if you notice, it says see. It doesn't say, that just means you can suddenly see what Christ has already done for you. It's like turning the light on. It's when the light gets turned on for you. And we don't have any control over that. It's what I want. That's what I want you to see, is that when you're born again, you have no control. That's different than what the world thinks. The world thinks that you need to go get yourself born again. You better accept Christ into your life and you become born again. Say this little prayer. All of them have something you have to do in order to get yourself born again. I think if we read this, we see it's totally different than that. Christ said you got to be born again to see, and again, I emphasize the see the kingdom of God. And Nicodemus, of course, was talking to him, and Nicodemus, thank goodness, asked dumb questions, because dumb questions help us understand. Nicodemus says, what do you mean I got to be born again? You mean I got to get back in my mother's body and be physically born again? He's thinking about it being physical, and of course, Christ is talking about being spiritual. And Christ then lays it out, I think, pretty clear. He said, verily I say unto you, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. Born of the water and Spirit, and he talks about here in verse 6, especially, that which is born of the flesh is flesh, that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. He said, there's two births. There's a physical birth, and there's a spiritual birth. And he doesn't separate them out. He doesn't say there's any distinction between two of them. how they work. Now, if I'm going to ask you, I could ask over here about her baby boy. Is your baby boy walking yet? Well, you can't walk physically until you've been born spiritually. You can't talk physically until you've been born physically. We understand that. Somebody asked me, Don, did you plan the day you were going to be born on? I had nothing to do with the day I was going to be born on. That was all taking place. My mother had a better idea. But as we know, even mothers and fathers don't know exactly when people are going to be born again, how that's going to go. He says, they both operate the same way, physical birth and spiritual birth. And the point is, you can't talk spiritually till you've been born. You can't talk physically till you've been born physically. You can't talk spiritually until you've been born spiritually. You can't do anything spiritual until actually you've been born spiritually. And he says, verse 7, Marvel not that I say unto you, you must be born again. In the law, we like to say, don't make a federal case out of this. That's what he's saying. He said, marvel not that I tell you, you must be born again. Don't be surprised. Don't be shocked. And don't make a big deal out of this. He said, you got to be born again, but you have no control over it. It's like physical birth. You know, physical birth and spiritual birth work the same in the fact that you have no control over either one of them. The Lord does. And that's what he says in verse 8. The wind bloweth where it listeth. The wind bloweth where it chooses. And thou hearest the sound thereof, but you can't tell when it cometh and when it goeth. You have no control over the wind at all. None whatsoever. And he said, that's the way it is the Spirit. That's the way the Spirit works. You may hear it, and you may know that it's coming, but you can't see it, and you can't control it. And I can look out here, and I can see the trees moving, and I can think, well, the wind's blowing. I can see the effect of the wind. You can see the effect of when the Spirit moves on somebody and makes them born again, changes their life. They understand a lot more about what the Lord has done to them. You know, being born again, I've used this before, but there's two examples that the whole world, as far as I know, agrees with. I don't know anybody that disagrees. We know when John the Baptist was born again. We know when the Apostle Paul was born again. Very real clear, that's when the Spirit came upon him. If you go read about John the Baptist, he was born again while he was still in his mother's womb. When Mary walked in the room with Jesus inside her womb, it said John the Baptist was filled with the Holy Ghost and leapt in the womb. He leapt in his mother's womb. Everybody agrees, that's when John the Baptist was born again. What control did John the Baptist have over that? He was still in his mother's womb. That was the Lord's, Spirit of the Lord acting on him before he was even physically born. In this case, spiritual birth took place before physical birth. Let's look at the Apostle Paul. Apostle Paul was on the road to Damascus and was struck down by the Lord. He'd been a bad guy. I mean, for somebody that I'd looked at and said, that guy's not a child of God. He was going out and killing people that was worshiping Christ. Anybody he went out and found preaching the word or listening to the word, he arrested them, men, women, and children, and hauled them into court. He was given open-ended arrest warrants, as we'd call them. He arrested people and dragged them in. He was responsible for the slaughter of many of the Lord's people. Bad guy. But then he was on the road to Damascus, and the Lord struck him down there. And everybody agrees that that's when he was born again. He looked up and said, you know, who art thou, Lord? He knew who it was. The minute he struck down, he knew he'd been struck down. And it was Christ speaking to him, and Christ revealed himself to him. And, you know, we know he changed him from that point forward. And he began then to understand and feel. He felt guilty his whole life about what he'd done to the Christian church before he was born again. It changed him. What control did he have over being born again? Zero. Neither one of those two examples that we all agree on, neither one, John the Baptist or Apostle Paul, neither one of them had any control over it. And you ask people about that, and they'll say, well, those two were special cases. Well, they were historical cases, and they were examples, but they were not special cases. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest sound thereof, and y'all can tell when it cometh and when it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit. Everyone that is born again the same way, just like John the Baptist, just like the Apostle Paul, and that's that you have no control over that. There's a lot of symbolism in here, he's telling you that, but I think he makes that point clear. But people don't go read this section. They don't actually read it and apply it, and that's part of the problems of the world. Now, what I want to do now is spend my time on it. In the New Testament, we have three examples, physical examples, of where Jesus revived people that were dead. He revived them and brought them back to life. And I think those are in there for a reason, because they give us a great symbolic look of how we work and the connection of the physical things with the spiritual things. First one I want to talk to you about is over in Luke chapter 7. It's about when Jesus went to a little small town called Nain. It's Luke 7, beginning in verse 11. Jesus went to this little town called Nain, and we're going to see that he resurrected the life of a child, a young boy, who was dead. Verse 11 of Luke 7. And it came to pass the day after he had just finished healing a centurion servant who was ill, he wasn't dead, and right after he spoke on the Sermon on the Mount. So it's making reference back to some other things. But it came to pass the day after that, he went into a city called Nain. Now, Nain is about 7 or 8 miles underneath Nazareth, up close to the Sea of Galilee, up where Christ was born in that area. Small town, Also, Cana was up there. That's where he went and performed the miracle of changing water into wine. A couple of his early miracles were up there in the area where he was born, not down in Jerusalem. So it came to pass, he went into a city called Nain. It's a very small little community. Today, it's Nein. It's still there in Israel, and you can look it up on the map, but it's a very small town still. And many of his disciples went with him, and much people. He had a big crowd following him. So he had a big crowd following Christ as he went into town. They were happy. They were following him and worshiping. Verse 12, and now when he came nigh unto the gates of the city, when he entered the gates of the city, and most of these towns in Israel at that time were walled cities. They had kind of some kind of a wall around them so they could protect themselves. But they always had a main gate you went into, and that's where all the business was done. That's where, you know, a lot of things took place. Public announcements were all made at the gate of the city. When he came in nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and much people of the city was with her. So she had a big crowd following this funeral procession. You know, you see funeral processions, and the ones I think about are the ones in New Orleans where they march down the street, and they've got the coffin there, and then everybody's marching with it. And that's what's taking place here. You got a man, it indicates he was young because it was her only son. She was a widow. I don't know how old the boy was. I don't remember. I was trying to think it's small, but we'll see. I'm thinking getting confused with another example that'll follow this in a minute. He was a young man, could have been adult, but a young man, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Now think about this. She was a widow, and she lived in a small town, not a lot of resources to take care of widows and orphans and those things there. She's got her son now that she's going to depend on to live with her and take care of her and help her, and now he's died. She is grieving. She's in a lot of pain. This is her only son. Of course, then you got all these followers in the town that are following along with her. They're heading out of the gate, out to the cemetery to bury her. Now, in the Jews in those days, they had a doctrine, that you buried people within 24 hours of the death. They usually buried them the same day. Within the same day, and that meant within less than 24 hours after they died. That was just the standard. That's back to Deuteronomy. It's also in Acts chapter 5, I guess, where it talks about they buried a husband and wife. They buried a husband before his wife even knew he was dead. They went ahead and buried him and then buried her when she died later too. And she's got this crowd following her that are mourning with her. One thing we see back in the Old Testament, and I'll talk about it with the next example, is people that are mourners with you. That's good, and it can be bad. But we'll see here, anyway, you got two crowds. You got one crowd following Christ coming into the city, and you got a crowd with this dead boy and his widowed mother going out of the city, and so they kind of meet here head on. Verse 13, the Lord saw this woman was grieving. He knew she was a widow. He knew that this was her only son. Now think of this. First of all, you got two crowds. You got two only sons. Christ was the only begotten son of the Lord. He's coming in, and he's going to die for the people. And you've got this boy who was the only son of his widowed mother going out. So just a few comparisons there. Verse 13, when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said unto her, weep not. Told her, don't weep not. Now, you know, that'd be kind of hard if, you know, mother would go, yeah, it's easy for you to say, you know, but he assured her, don't weep. And he came and touched the bier, B-I-E-R. That's a casket without a lid on it, is what that amounts to. It's an open casket. You've probably seen them on TV sometime where they'll carry the body and you can actually see the body. But it's laying in probably made out of wood or small logs or something. They'll make a bier and put blankets and quilts in it. So the body's laying there just like it would be in a casket, but doesn't have a lid on it so that you can actually see the body. That's what that's talking about. They came and touched the bier, and he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. The people, the pallbearers, as we would call them, they froze in place when Christ came and touched the casket and the body. Now keep in mind, in those days, a priest, and you know, Christ, we know, was a priest, would be seen as that. It was unlawful for them to touch something dead. That made you unclean. And so you stayed away from dead bodies. The people that prepared it had to prepare a body, and then they had to remove themselves and everybody, and because they became, quote, unclean under the law until they were clean, because bodies many times carried disease and a lot of problems with that. And of course, that's one reason they buried him within the same day. But he came and touched the bier, and they that bare it stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." Now, he didn't ask him to sit up. This was a command. And I feel certain he said it, and he said it in such a manner that everybody heard it. Of course, I'm sure everybody was frozen, and they were still watching what's going on. He said, "Young man," that's where I got the young man, yeah. "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." This is the same way he does to you. When he gives a command, there's no resisting it. He gives a command like this. It's the voice of God speaking, "Arise." And he that was dead sat up and began to speak. The man, can you imagine the impact this had on both crowds? The crowd following Christ and the crowd coming out. And look at this now. You have Christ coming into the city and people following him, and he's life. Christ represents life. He represents a resurrection and life. And those that are Christ's people, we never die. That's the point I want to emphasize. You don't die. You may close your eyes when your body dies, but you're immediately in heaven. You do not see physical death. Your body does, but we know it'll be reunited later in the resurrection. But you don't die. That's one of the things about comfort. When Christ is there and in you, you don't die. And that's spiritual. We know that. It's a spiritual sense. You're not going to die because your soul goes to heaven. Your body dies naturally and starts decomposing and goes in the ground. It will come out again, though, on resurrection day. But here, it's talking about, you know, you have people following Christ. He's going into the city. Other people are going out of the city and heading to the cemetery. Christ stopped that. The symbolism here is, you're not going to die. Now, in a physical sense, you do, but spiritually don't. But he brought him back alive. These are symbolic of what's taking place. "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." And he that was dead sat up and began to speak. You talk about shock to the mother and all the people there. I mean, even before you can rejoice, you've got to be scared a little bit about, you know, there's a big joke going around about, you know, undertakers there, and somebody who sits up in the coffin. It scares everybody to death when that occurs. It had to scare them immediately about what's going on here. You don't know whether this is some kind of crazy cultist issue or whatever initially. So it caught everybody off guard. He began to speak, and he, that's just being by Christ delivered him to his mother. Now, it would have been natural for, this is the compassion of Christ and the time salvation he gives each one of us, it'd have been natural if this man would become immediately a follower of Christ, would go off with Christ and followed him. But in this case, Christ had compassion on the mother. Now, the boy would have been better off going on to heaven, because he'd immediately gone to heaven. We know he's better off that way. But Christ had compassion on the widow and returned the boy to her. Think about what great comfort that provided to her, timely and physically. I got my son back. And think about, took the worry of her. She was alone and going to be alone for the rest of her life and nobody to help her, take care of her. And suddenly, she's got her son, a young man, back with her. And Christ made a point of delivering him back to his mother. She's going to have him now to help her, live with her, and take care of her. It says, verse 16, "And there came a fear on all, and they glorified God." They were scared at first because these guys came back alive. And then they realized what happened, and they glorified all and said, "A great prophet is risen up among us. God hath visited his people." And this rumor of him went forth throughout all Judea and spoke all the region around about. All Christ had to do was say, "Young man, arise." And that was a command. And he overrode death. He had power over death and overrode it by speaking. Did he have to speak? No. He just, if you look in the first part of that chapter where he'd healed a young man, he didn't even go to his house. He just says, "Okay, when you get home, the young man will be healed." And he was. So he didn't have to go there. But he did this as a witness to all the people of his power. And we need to see it too. He has the power over death, complete power over death. Death not only for this boy, but also death for us. Let's go down to the second example, if you would. I'm going to go back to Mark. This one I just gave you about the young man in the funeral procession, that's only in the book of Luke. The next one is back in Mark chapter 5, and it's about Jairus' daughter. This is in it's in three Gospels, in Matthew chapter 9 and Luke chapter 8, but I think Mark chapter 5 gives us the best picture. In a minute, I'm going to refer in one place. There's a different fact in Matthew I want to bring forward and a different fact in Luke that are not presented here in Mark, and I'll talk to those, but Mark is where I want to go. Mark chapter 5, beginning in verse 21. And this story is interrupted here because he's doing two miracles at once. I want to focus today. He's interrupted by the woman that comes to him and touches the hem of his garment, and she's healed. She had an issue of blood. Y'all are generally familiar with that. That's in here, and that's a good story, but I'm trying to not get off on a rabbit trail. I want to stay with what I want to look at. I want to look at the person who's dead. Verse 21 of Mark 5. And when Jesus was passed over again by the ship, he went across the Galilee Sea. That's just back up to that. He's just gone over and healed people, and there was a demon, a man that was possessed by demons, and Jesus took the demon out of him and put it into a herd of pigs, and the pigs ran down and went off the cliff. That's what's just taken place. So he's done a miracle. He's gotten and sailed back across the Sea of Galilee. That's where we are. When he was passed over again by ship unto the other side, much people gathered unto him, and he was nigh unto the sea. And behold, there cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet. Go over to Matthew, it says he fell and worshipped him. Now this is Jairus. He's the ruler of the synagogue. He's the high priest in the synagogue. He's a high Jewish leader in the synagogue. Now, remember, if you're at that time, the Jews didn't believe in Christ. They didn't believe he was the Son of God, and they didn't believe he was the Savior that was coming. So Jairus was really out on a limb going against all the other Jewish leaders because he came, he was one of the rulers of the local synagogue, but all the other Pharisees and Sadducees would have been opposed to what he's doing. Don't go put your faith in this guy. He's a fake. He claims to be the Son of God, but he's not really. And they, of course, they didn't want to see him coming because it was going to mess up their leadership. All the Pharisees and Sadducees would no longer be leaders in the country in their religion. So Jairus is going out on a limb by taking this. Jairus is his name, and he went and saw him. He fell and worshipped at his feet. That's what Matthew tells us about worship. And he besought him greatly, saying, "My little daughter lieth at the point of death." My daughter is about to die. She's alive, but she's deathly sick and about to die. "I pray thee, come and lay thy hands on her, that she might be healed, and she shall live." He was saying, come and heal her of her disease. He had just seen what's taking place with Christ healing these people that are possessed, you know, healing all manner of people that's got problems. And he just said, come and get to her before she dies and heal her so that she won't die. That's what he's asking her to do. Verse 24, and Jesus went with him, and much people followed him and thronged him. A lot of people went around and gathered around him. They want to see more of these miracles he's going to do. Now, I'm going to skip from verse 25 down to 35. This is the part that's good, but it's about this woman who had this issue of blood, part of the plague, as she called it. And she touched the hem of his garment, and you know, the minute she touched his garment, she was healed, but Christ turned around immediately. I know somebody touched him, and he was in a crowd, but she just touched the hem of his coat, and he knew then somebody touched him, and that's talking about that. She had great faith, and he said that. She had great faith, and he said, go thy way, and you'll be healed. Now, verse 35, it picks back up. He's still with Jairus. Jairus is traveling along with him when this woman interrupts his travel, and he stops and loses some time taking care of this woman and talking to her. Verse 35, it picks back up. While he yet spake, there came from the ruler of the synagogue's house. Jairus is with him. One of the other people that is in his house came and caught up with him and talked to Jairus and said, I got to tell you, your daughter is dead. Why troublest thou the master any further? Don't bother Christ anymore. Your daughter's already died. It's too late. You can't help her because she's already dead. As soon as Jesus heard the word that is spoken, he saith unto Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, be not afraid, only believe. He always provided a peaceful thought. He told the widow woman over there, weep not. Here he said, be not afraid, but believe. And he suffered no man to follow him save Peter, James, John, come with him. He was Jairus, and he had this big throng around him, but he said, everybody else stay. Only Peter, John, and James, the three leaders of the apostles, go with him. He said, that's all I want with me. And he cometh to the house, because everybody else was not interested in compassion and that. Majority of them, you know, wanted to see the miracle. I want to go see the magic show. They all wanted to go see, you know, we're all interested in that. I'd go see these magicians, the Houdinis of the world, and the latest ones, how they make elephants disappear. My curiosity wants to go see that, because it's a great show. That's what a lot of them were in there for, was for that. And so he said, no, I don't want anybody to go with me except Peter, John, and James, the three of his leadership apostles, and of course, the father of the little girl, Jairus. And he cometh to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and seeth the tumultuous problem, and them that wept and wailed greatly. Now, you've all seen these at funerals every now and then, and especially as old days, it's not quite as prevalent today, except I have seen it even recently, where you go to the house where somebody's died, and everybody comes over. And it's custom, and it's a good thing to go over and you bring food. You want to help out the family, and that's a good thing. But we know there's some what I call professional mourners. They show up, and they're going to sit in there, and they're going to cry and mourn. All I want to do is state the facts. I'm not pointing out anybody in particular. I don't know if anybody in this room does that. But they'll show up. And I think they're seeking as much attention to themselves as they are to help the family. I've seen this. It used to be in the old days, we had people that were professional mourners. They'd show up at everybody's house who had a funeral and were mourning. And that's what's going on here. You'll see elsewhere in the Bible where it's talked about that people, when you're mourning someone, you don't have to be private about it, but you do it quietly. You suffer your grief quietly. If you go and you see people that follow this, you can tell. They may have been crying and they're grieving, but they greet you. And those, especially those that know that the person that's died is better off now than they were earlier. That's what Apostle Paul tells us, grieve, but don't grieve as those without no hope. If you see people wailing like that and crying loudly, and if you go over in Matthew, one of those places, it says when Jesus got there, the minstrels were there. People come over to play instruments in the house when somebody dies. They're playing instruments because they're playing what I call funeral music. They're not doing dance music or rock music or rapping or anything like that, but they're playing music. And, you know, anytime you see a show where there's a funeral going on in a church, you know, it's the music that accompanies funerals, you know, sad songs. And the commentaries say about this, it says it makes people that are sad, it actually makes them sadder. Rather than being happy for the person that died, I'm sad because, you know, I've lost a spouse before, and I was sad because I lost my spouse, but I knew she wasn't suffering from the dreaded cancer she had anymore. So I'm happy inside because I know the truth, and I understand it. But you've got people here, and that's what's going on here. A lot of people are here, and they're crying out loud, and they're wailing, and the minstrels are playing this real sad music, and all that's going on. That's what it says in Matthew's. People are there playing the music. And he sees there and he sees the tumult. There's a lot of noise and racket going on here. People talking and crying. You know, how are you going to get along? How are you going to live? They're talking, they're depressing. They take the people that are depressed and they make it worse. And that's what he's talking going on here. And them that wept and wailed greatly. He's not talking about the family. He's talking about the professional mourners that sometimes show up. And when he was come in, he said unto them, why make ye this ado? Why are you doing all this? Why are you making such a big ado over what's taking place here? And the damsel is not dead, but she sleepeth. Christ knows what he's about to do. And he knows that death is sleeping. And really, that's what death is. Now, we may sleep for a little longer than normal. But what's the difference between death and sleep? It's how long they last. Sleep's going to last. I used to say 8 hours. Now with me, it's about 4 hours. Then I have to start over again, 4 or 5 hours, start over. But the difference between sleeping and death is just a matter of a little time. Death lasts longer, but your body is just sleeping. It's going to be called and resurrected to join with your spirit at some point in time. But so he's talking about sleeping, but of course he's talking about a short period of time here. And they all laughed at him to scorn. All the people that mourning, you know, again, there's some people that want to mourn. They want to mourn in a manner that it also draws them attention to them too. And they laughed because they said, she's dead. And you know, what are you talking about? She's sleeping. She's dead. Do you not understand that? And they're laughing at him. But when he had put them all out, go back into Matthew and Luke and submit a little clearer. He said, go forth, get out of here. He clears out all the crowd except for his three apostles, Peter, Paul, Peter, James, and John, clears them out and takes the mother and father. That's all he allows to stay in the house. He cleared the house out of all the noise and everything that's going on because they didn't believe him anyway. They said he's dead. He took the father and the mother of the damsel and them that were with him, Peter, John, and James, and entered into where the damsel was laying. And he took the damsel by the hand and said unto her, now, you know, we got a song about, you know, he takes me by the hand and leads me to the promised land. It's good symbolic here. He took by the hand, and that's what he does when you die. When you die, your spirit doesn't die. Your soul doesn't die. The body does. But he immediately takes you by the hand and leads you to the promised land. When you close your eyes in death, you open your eyes immediately in the presence of the Lord. That's why, you know, people say, you old Baptists are not afraid of death. I respect it. And we're told we don't want to die. It's not our plan is to want to die, but we're not afraid of it because we actually know it's improved. Now, my limited brain in this world, I'm going, I know it's proven. I believe it and I have faith in it. I don't know what that really means. I don't think we even begin to have a clue what that means and how good that will be. Your body quits aching. It quits decomposing. All the sin and all the pain is gone, and you're in the presence of the Lord forever. There'll be a kind of time come when we have the resurrection. You'll be united with your body, and your body will be a perfect body. Then you won't have pains, and it won't grow. And I don't know how that's going to work, but I believe it. I believe it very strongly. Here, it's the faith that we talked about last time. He took the damsel by the hand and said unto her, Talitha kumi. I'm sure that's Latin, and I can't say that, but it says, Mark tells us here, which is being interpreted, damsel, I say unto thee, arise. The same thing he told the young man on the bier. And again, he didn't have to say it, but he's saying it for those people that are there that see, damsel, arise. And straightway, that tells me immediately, the damsel arose and walked, for she was the age of 12 years. And they were astonished with great astonishment, even his own apostles and the mother and dad. The minute he said, arise, she'd been dead. She'd been dead, you know, for probably a day. And they were, all he had to do was speak. And he didn't even have to speak. We know that. But he did. He does that for us. So we can see it and we can understand what he's doing. At his command, she woke up and she was in astonishment. She woke up and started walking around. And Jesus charged them straightly that no man should know of it. He didn't want to do it for the show. He's doing it to show the power of God to his disciples there. And he commanded that something should be given her to eat. And all three of the Gospels confirmed that he commanded, now she's awake, bring her, give her something to eat, feed her. Now, when he takes someone and he puts himself in your body, you may not know the name of Jesus and you may not know what's going on, but he says, what he says we're to do, that's the ministry and that's the church, feed them. Give them some gospel. Give them some good gospel food. Let them be nourished off the gospel so now they understand what's just happened to them. Take care of them, feed them, give them, give them. It's like coming, that's what you come to church for, hopefully, is to be fed. Be fed of the good news so that you understand. I'm not going to die. You know, God has made me free. Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. I still sin, but the law doesn't apply to me anymore. If you're a child of God, the law doesn't apply to you, or you'd go to hell because you can't get to heaven if you've broken the law. So the law of sin and death. You don't die. You close your eyes when the body dies, but immediately you're in heaven because your soul goes immediately. And if you go here, this in Mark, verse 40, Mark 6, verse 43, commanded to give something to eat. If you go look at it in Luke, it says, when he took her by the hand and said, arise, immediately her spirit came back in her. See, when you die, your spirit left. Her body was still there. And that's the way we are. But her spirit was already gone. He said, when he said, arise and brought her back to life, says her spirit immediately came back to her. That's why we know that immediately when you die, just like when you're born, look at Adam. When Adam was born, Lord took the dust out of the earth and formed it into a man. It was just a lifeless body. says, then, you know, God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life and made him a living soul. He formed Adam, and it was just a lifeless body, a dead body, you might say. And then when Christ, last thing that the Lord did, he breathed into his nostrils, made him a living soul. The last thing in making you is to put a soul in you. When you die, the first thing to do, God claims that soul back. Now, the body's still there, and we put the body back in the ground from which it came, dust to dust. But now we know the body won't stay there. It's sleeping. And then the Lord will come get it, whether you're in the grave and decomposed, or whether your ashes are in the 911 building that got burned up, or whether you're a seaman that was killed in Arizona in Pearl Harbor, then your body is disintegrated. The Lord will put all that back together, put all it back together in a perfect body. If you go with me now to the third example, another one you know, but I want to point out a couple of things. John chapter 11. There's three examples in the New Testament where Christ brought somebody back to life. One was the young boy at Nain. The second was the daughter of Jairus. And the third one is in John chapter 11, a man named Lazarus. You've heard of Lazarus, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this story because y'all know it generally. But we know that chapter 11, verse 1, there was a certain man that was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Martha and her sister Mary. You can read this a little bit, but Jesus knew these three. He was friends of the family. He'd gone and stayed with them before. Martha and Mary getting this debate about who should be helping Christ. And he tells Martha, quit worrying about it. Mary's chosen the right way. But he's sick. And verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And he had heard, therefore, that Lazarus was sick, but he abode 2 days in the same place where they were. Now, it was a good way from where he were. He was up north. He had to come down to Judea. And so it's a good 1 day's travel. Well, somebody has come and told him that Lazarus is sick. That's 1 day. It takes him a day to go back. Jesus is there 2 days. He doesn't even leave when he finds out he's sick. He stays around 2 more days. Jesus knows he's going to die. And his disciples are trying to talk him out of going down there. Verse 8, his disciples said unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee. And thou goest thither again. You're going to go back down into Bethany where all the Jews are. They're going to kill you. Christ turns him down and says, don't worry. In verse 11, he said, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of his sleep. And then in the apostles here are just like us. What do you mean he's asleep? If he's sleeping, that's good, because you sleep. If you're sleeping, that means you're getting better and you're getting well. And Christ finally tells them plainly in verse 14, Lazarus is dead. That's what I'm trying to tell you. He's dead. But to me, I have control over death. He's just sleeping. That's what he tells them. Let me skip over here a little bit. Verse 17, Jesus came, he found that he had been laying in the dead 4 days. He'd been laid in the grave 4 days and already been there. Time he got there, you know, and the Martha and Mary, the sisters of Lazarus, are a little bit disappointed. They still believe in the Lord because they've seen him perform miracles, but they're a little disappointed because he didn't come. He's been dead 4 days now. People thought he could heal people that were sick, but they didn't know he had power over death. And that's the story in all these, power over death. On both the first time and second time, all he had to do was speak, and the person came back alive. That's why this is symbolic of what he does to us. Verse 23, he tells Martha, he says, Jesus said to her, thy brother shall rise again. He says, you know, I'm the resurrection. I have power over death. That's what he's telling them. And you go through here, and I'll skip some of this down here. But it gets down to verse 34, and Jesus asks her, where have you laid him? Where have you buried him? Where did you put him? You don't know where you lay him around or whatever? And Christ knew, but he wanted them to point this out to him. And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Verse 35, Jesus wept. He was a man, and he was close to these people. He loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, and so he cried. And then he then said to the Jews, behold how he loves him. And some of them said, could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? They're questioning that. You know, Jesus groans a little bit. He said, you know, the Jewish people did not understand who he was, so every time they talk away, he groaned. But anyway, he came, and it says Lazarus was buried in a cave, and a stone lay upon the cave. Now, this was before he was buried. That's the same way he was buried, put in a cave, and a big stone rolled over it. Verse 39, Jesus said, take away the stone. And Martha, the sister of Lazarus, said, he's dead, and said, Lord, he's been in there 4 days. He's stinking. He's rotting. He's decomposing, as we know dead people do. They buried him within a day because they needed to get him in the ground. They didn't have embalming then. the Egyptians came up with the bobbing, but the Jewish people didn't have the equipment or the resources to do that yet and hadn't learned. So they had to bury them in a day because they know their body's going to start rotting. Now, Lazarus is a beautiful picture of how Christ finds us. This is part of the deal about, you know, we believe in that we're all sinners. We're all born sinners. And this is not a subject we like to talk about, is that how we're all born in sin. We're all, I've lost the word about when someone's dead, and I've lost the word on it now, when we're dead in sins. But anyway, it's a doctrine we don't like to preach too much, how we're all sinners and all damned. We're all depravity. That's what, thank you, Brother Joe. The doctrine of depravity. We don't like to preach the doctrine of depravity because I got to tell you how bad you are. But it's important you understand the doctrine of depravity so then you have a clear picture of the beautiful doctrine of grace, of the Lord's grace and what he does for you. And he saves you from that depravity. Now, this is what Lazarus represents. He's dead and he's stinking. And that's the way we are to the Lord. He's perfect. He looks at us, you know, and, you know, I've said, you know, I try to do good, but probably before I leave today, I'm going to have a bad thought I shouldn't be having, or before I get home, I'm going to have 20 more and may not even realize all of them at the time. When I do realize it, then I feel guilty for thinking that way or for feeling that way, or I may get mad at somebody and may even be wrong about it. So we've all in depravity, and that's what the Lord comes and finds us, and that's where Lazarus is. He's dead. He's stinking. We're dead in trespasses and sins. We're dead in depravities of ourselves. And the Lord comes and saves us. That's why it's a beautiful picture. He's been dead for 4 days and he's stinking. And Jesus said unto her, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God. If you'll believe, you'll see the glory of God here. And it's what he tells them. And he goes in and he prays to God and he says, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. He's praying to let him, the Lord will let him save Lazarus. And he says, now, I know you hear me. I don't have to talk for you to hear me. He said, I know that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. He does a lot of things physically so that we can see it and we can understand it. That's how we understand. That's why he's trying to teach us about spiritual things. But he'll sometimes cause things to be done spiritually physically, so that we'll believe it. And that's what he's doing. And he that was, well, and says, and when, verse 43, and when he thus had spoken, he cried out with a loud voice. What does Christ do every time someone dies and brings them back? He speaks to the body. Told these, you know, that young man and that young lady, arise. And upon his voice, on the command of his voice, things change. Says he, when he had spoken with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus say, oh, let me think about it. Now, you know, when I say, you know, Christ offers me salvation, does he offer it to me? And I said, let me think about that, Lord. No, I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm not sure I want to change. Did Lazarus have a choice? Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus came off that table. He didn't have any choice. That's irresistible grace. We cannot resist Lord. That's what they're telling us here. It's what he's confirming for us, giving us a beautiful picture by symbolism. Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth. He's dead. He came off that table dead. He raised him off that table and brought him to life somewhere in that. Now, Lazarus, we'll see, when it says, he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot. He'd already been, like they do a mummy, he'd already been wrapped up. In the wrappings that they made them, you know, look like mummies in. That's how they wrapped them up tight to try to preserve the body. He was round up hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound with a napkin. His face was covered up, tied tight. He was bound up hand and foot. He couldn't walk. He couldn't move. You know, if anybody's ever done that to you, you know, you might be able to squirm around a while and finally get off the bed or something. Somebody did that to you. But if you're bound tight enough, you can't do anything. That's the way he was. But yet, he came forth. No question in my mind, he floated in there and he came right off that table, alive. Now look what Christ tells him. Christ tells the people, loose him and let him go. Now when Christ comes to you, puts himself in your heart, you don't have any choice. He's coming, thank goodness. I'd be dumb enough to turn him down. He comes to you, and that's irresistible grace. He comes and puts himself in your heart, and you don't have any choice but to come. You know, no man can come to me except the Father who sent me draw him, and the Lord draw him. You know, it's like that's where he gets it out of a chest of drawers. You have to go over there and get that drawer and open it up. You draw it out. That's where he gets his name. You draw it out. That's what the Lord does to you. He draws you in. That's what happened here. The Lord Christ drew him off that table. Now, what job does he give the people? Loose him and let him go. Take those bandages off and let him go. Take the bonds that are holding him down and let him go. Take the napkin off and let him see. That's what the gospel is all about. When you come to church, when you read the Bible, when you study and you pray, you're being loosed. You are under the bonds of sin right now, and dead in trespasses and sin. And when you hear the gospel preached in all its glory, and you see what he's done, it makes you free. When you hear the truth, you become free. You know the truth, and the truth makes you free. The bonds are taken off. That's why Apostle Paul tells us, you know, that life in Christ has made me free from the law of sin and death. Free today. I may be free naturally, free when the time comes, but I don't know it. But hearing the gospel preached, and that's what the people do, they don't save you, but they help you, minister to you, and let you know what Christ has done for you. That's what's happening here. Take off the bonds and let him go. Let him see that he's now free. That's the symbolism that's taking place here in all three of these deaths. Then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. But some of them still went their ways to Pharisees and told them the things Jesus had done. Some people still didn't believe him. I'm going to close with one verse back in the first part of John, at John chapter 5. I'll skip some of this in the interest of time. John chapter 5, verse 25. It's Christ speaking, said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead that are in the graves, the dead shall hear the voice of God, and they that hear shall live. For the Father hath life into himself, so he hath given it to the Son to have life in himself, and he's given it to other people. And said, marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in their graves, that's everybody that's already died, in their graves, shall hear his voice, and they shall come forth, they that have done good into the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil into the resurrection of the damnation." As I mentioned before, there is one resurrection. There's not two or three or whatever they talk about under the modern philosophies today. And there's not a thousand-year reign. When he speaks, just like he did to these people, when he speaks in the trump of the Lord's sound, he comes down with a shout. Immediately, everybody in the graves are coming out. All of those of us that are fortunate enough, I guess, to be around then, we'll go right behind those people in the graves and we'll go to heaven and be there immediately. In the minute, though, the people that come out of the graves, that's just their bodies. They'll be joined together with their souls and spirits in the air to live forever with the Lord. Now, we have great symbolism in this about how this works, how this being born again works. In each of these cases, he's saving these lives. It's very symbolic of what he does with each one of us that is born again. I appreciate your kind attention. My prayer is that the Lord will let you bless each one of you. Do we have a song, Brother Gary?